I'm going to just cover one verse this morning. Text 27. It's a nice verse. We heard a lot in text 26. This I particularly appreciated this Prabhupada's explanation that dhyan, which is stage number 7 of the Ashtanga Yoga system, corresponds with stage number 3 of the Bhakti system, Vishnu Smaranam. So Smaranam, remembrance, remembering Krishna, is dhyan. Something I read long ago, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wrote that when one engages in memorizing verses, committing them to memory, so that means, you know, they sit in your heart and they appear, they arise, and you meditate on them both, you know, from the outside in and the inside out. That's dhyan. Similar to what we've been hearing. She heard instructions, she was meditating on those instructions, and she was in a fixed state of mind. The mind wasn't wavering. We may be better off without it, because in and out is distracting. Now it's on, but now it's off. Just shut it off. Okay. Then we can leave it because of this. And that, yet another reference that we've been hearing, I think it's good to repeat it again and again and again, because hearing again and again helps remembrance and also helps us carry it in our heart. This reference from Bhagavata Mahatmya, from Padma Purana, these four things. The fourth of them, matir, the mind concentrating on instructions that are heard. So first is you have to hear the instructions properly before you can concentrate on the instructions. You may concentrate on something else, or the mind is moving, not concentrating on anything. But to get that reference is to get the full benefit of Bhagavatam. Padma Purana is teaching us that you, the same, dhyan, or concentrating the mind on instructions heard. So she's done that, and of course the instructions specifically mentioned are the process of meditation itself upon Vishnu, because Kapila described that earlier, and the ways of life of one who is doing that, specifically even in grihastha life, ways of living one's life that's complementary to fixing your mind on the personality of Godhead. And then Prabhupada adds name, form, qualities, and he says antaraj here in this section twice. So his pastimes with his devotees is antaraj. And that constitutes this dhyan. And then we heard, because it's going to appear again in this morning's verse from text 26, that's what you do, and then there's the result of what you do. And the result is material pangs disappear and transcendental bliss is entered. You plunge into transcendental bliss and material pangs disappear. The body gets old, the body gets diseased, the body dies and born again if one is not fixed in Krishna consciousness. So that's not, the pangs doesn't disappear, but the identification with those pangs disappears. So that's now the lead-in to this morning's verse, text 27. Nice. Nitya arudha samaditvat. Arudha is arudha, situated in. Nitya arudha samaditvat. So that this thing at the end, suffix vat, or it's having the quality of samadhi. So nitya arudha samaditvat. She came to the stage where there was no wavering. It's trance, samadhi. We're getting like this kind of slow motion picture of going back to Godhead. So that we know what we need to do before we get there. Even, you know, like your GPS. In 2 miles, turn right. In half a mile, turn right. In 100 yards, turn right. Turn right. So the Bhagavatam is giving us this GPS to go back to Godhead. Situated in eternal trance and freed from illusion, the Sanskrit word in the verse is Bhrama, not the other Lord Brahma, but Brahma. Brahma means illusion. There's 4 defects of the conditioned soul, and one of them is Bhrama. You accept what is not to be what is. It's illusion. And she became freed from illusion. Impelled by the modes of material nature. Paravritta. Freed from guna, the conditioning force of the modes of nature. So it's not the struggle, duratyaya, but it's beyond. So that's the teaching of Bhagavad Gita, mamivaya prapadyante. So she did, and she's now beyond the influence of the modes of nature are still there when one is transcendentally situated. But the modes of nature can't touch the soul that's in this stage of trance. We're going to hear that in the purport. She forgot her material body. Whoa. Na sasmara. Sasmara. It means smara is remembrance, and sasmara is like complete absorption. She was so absorbed in her true identity, she forgot. The covering. And the comparison is just like when you're asleep and in the dreaming state, and then you wake up. And then when you wake up, You may or may not remember the dream, but you don't identify with it anymore. That wasn't you. The seat of consciousness, seeing the body that wasn't you, and moving around in circumstances that also wasn't, you know, real circumstances. The dream is over, and the pleasure or pain or fear or lust or greed or whatever it is. The emotion, both the activity and the emotion connected with the activity, it's gone. Like, you know, there was no tiger, and there was no throne to sit on. You may dream, so you may fly in the sky. It's not. And there you are in the sky, looking down. I used to have a dream like that, a recurring dream. It was very interesting. It just kept coming. I didn't know what was going on, but, you know, it was a dream of in the backyard of a house once upon a time when I was small. We lived this big, old-fashioned kind of backyard. And there was this, there I was, a bird flying around, circling around, looking down at, you know, the backyard. I never looked down at the backyard, but I was seeing the backyard looking down. And it wasn't, anyway. So it's just the combination, as Prabhupada says, you can't dream of something that you have not experienced. So the impression of something, once upon a time, we had a bird body or something that flew around. And then there's the backyard. You put the two together and you get, you're in a dream, you're flying. Prabhupada mentions it regularly, so perhaps he also had such a dream where he was flying, looking down, or whatever he was looking out or something. And the dream's over, that's this swapne drishtam. Drishta is you see. Swapne drishtam evotita. Evotita, just like when you arise, that which you see in your dream is gone. You're gone. So again, the translation, situated in eternal trance and free from illusion, impelled by the modes of material nature, she forgot her material body, just as one forgets his different bodies in a dream. Purport, a great Vaishnava said that he who has no remembrance of his body is not bound to material existence. As long as we are conscious of our bodily existence, it is to be understood that we are living conditionally. Wow, you're supposed to forget your body. What does that mean?
No, it's just a quick clarification on the verse. It says, impelled by the modes of nature.
Yeah.
That's referring to her body identification when she doesn't have it before her.
It's the illusion. And the illusion is, yes, the bodily identification and all that goes with it. You know, the varieties of what's out there that you're identifying with.
It wasn't referring to her new feeling.
No. Religion. No. Because here's the answer, again. As long as we are conscious of our bodily existence, comma, it is to be understood that we are living conditionally, comma, under the three modes of material nature. Again, when one forgets his bodily existence, his conditional material life is over. This forgetfulness is actually possible when we engage our senses in the transcendental living service of the Lord. In the conditional state, one engages his senses as a member of a family, or as a member of a society, or country. But when one forgets all such membership, this is upadhi, in material circumstances, and realizes that he is an eternal servant of the Supreme Lord, that is actual forgetfulness of material existence. Paragraph. It kind of raises a question in your mind, doesn't it? Like, what happened to the prescribed duties part of life in Bhagavad Gita's instruction? Like, you just forget prescribed duties. The heck with it. Karma sannyas, right? That's not what it means. This forgetfulness actually occurs when one renders service unto the Lord. A devotee no longer works with the body for sense gratification, with family, society, country, humanity, and so on. He simply works for the Supreme Personality, Godhead, Krishna. That is perfect Krishna consciousness. So extracting the message, we may still perform prescribed duties, act with according to our psychophysical nature. That the modes of nature are still acting. The body is still there. It's still, you know, you minimize, as she has done, sleeping, eating, etc. Prior to that, it's regulating. That was the reference that was made. Regulating, eating, sleeping, work, recreation, and then one can be properly situated and peaceful. And this is beyond peaceful. This is ecstatic. So she's still doing things. There's still some eating and some sleeping, and reducing, but she's not identifying with those things, or these are sources of happiness, or the absence of them is the source of misery, like fasting, tapasya. It's one of the human characteristic from this other austerity. We cultivate voluntarily, not because, oh, that's good, it hurts, so that's something that must mean it's good. Or the more that we can bear, we become stoic, and then we become spiritually elevated just because we became a stoic, we became a tapasvi. That's not it. But it's not finding happiness in those things. And then, you know, the positive is finding happiness in one's relationship with Krishna. So one may still do the tapasya, or whatever are the other things of family, society, country, etc. We don't break the law. You don't, unless you're an avaduta, you follow the law. So our great personalities, we look, and they Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advocated, follow the law. Gopinath, Patanayak, you're the servant of the king. You can't take the money of the king and use it for your own purposes. It's unlawful, and the king has every right to punish you as he feels fit. So it's not neglect in that sense. It's rather not finding the purpose of sense gratification, for sure, nor in and of themselves these are means of elevation. Rather, they're just part and parcel of this higher state of consciousness. That's my understanding of the forgetfulness. It's kind of extreme. The language is certainly extreme. I gave some example yesterday of when Prabhupada slipped and twisted his ankle and his arm, and he did something. He didn't forget it. He attended to it in a proper way. But his happiness or distress wasn't upon all bodily pain, and so many others. That's another Prabhupada story heard from Hari Suri. I heard from Hari Suri some time back. He was having a liver problem. Liver problem. And so one day we were sitting together. His Parkinson's disease gets kind of checked, but he can't hold his hand steady. His mind is steady, but his hand isn't, his body isn't. So he asked him, how's your liver situation? And he said, it's under control, I've taken certain medicine, da 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 da. And just because it's Hari Suri, his mind went to Prabhupada. And then was describing two situations with Prabhupada. One was, Prabhupada was able to bear pain in an unbelievable way. And he gave an example of Prabhupada had an abscess tooth. Abscess means there's infection and your whole jaw is swollen. And it's painful. So the devotees were recommending to Prabhupada to go to a dentist and have it attended to, whatever the dentist recommended. Prabhupada said, no, just give me cloves. had he just put cloves in his cheek so it's puffed out even more, he just endured the pains and went on with his service. Don't want to waste time and go to the dentist. That was Prabhupada. I mean, it's not us. It doesn't mean that's what you're supposed to do. And then sometime days later, Prabhupada was in the middle of taking prasadam. Hari Sori was there. He watched Prabhupada, reached in his mouth, yanked out the tooth, handed the tooth to Hari Sori, said, "Here, you can keep this," and went on with his prasadam, with his, you know, big abscess. So he was aware. The clothes just helped, you know, endure the pain. We would get whatever it is, some injection of Novocaine or something, or whatever it is, some, you know, treatment of antibiotic, and Prabhupada just pulled the tooth out with his fingers. Then one other story, that led to another story, and I didn't know this until he said this, but Prabhupada, which is it? One of the internal organs, and there's two of them in your body. Huh? Kidneys. Yeah, kidneys. Thank you. So, Hari Sori told me something I didn't know, that one of Prabhupada's kidneys was not functioning at all, and another of the kidney was half functioning, which meant the toxins that normally are eliminated from the body by the kidneys removing them and urine carrying them out of the body wasn't going on. So his body was becoming filled with toxins. And you know what that does. I mean, if you don't know, it drains your energy and it's painful, both. Now that was the reason Hari Sori explained how Prabhupada had massage, because it would just helped the toxins that were accumulated in the body become relieved from the body, drinking lots of liquid, and that way having it eliminated from the body, not through the kidneys. And so the massage was to help relieve toxins. It's just an Ayurvedic principle. So, he said, Prabhupada must have been in constant pain, but he never let on that he was in constant pain. He just was transcendental to the pain, or tolerated the pain, or was fixed in Krishna. He said there was only two occasions where Prabhupada stopped his service. He described one of them. It was middle of the night, 1 o'clock, or whatever it was in the morning. Prabhupada rang the bell, because Hari Sori was the servant, and that's how he called his servant, ringing the bell, something like a buzzer, not like a artik bell. And Hari Sori came, paid obeisances, and he saw Prabhupada with his chadar over his head, and his whole body was shivering. And he was seated and said, Prabhupada said, "It's too painful. I can't go on with my service." He was lamenting, not complaining. He said there was only one other occasion like that, but otherwise Prabhupada was in constant pain. But, you know, I never knew that until Hari Sori said it. And that was what the situation was when he was coming back to the West. I also didn't know that until I heard from him, that when he went to London and had to stop in London, went back to India, there was an operation of something with his kidneys. I don't know what that was, but that was the problem. It was part of his infirmity of body. So he wasn't unaware, but he was transcendental. That's this forgetfulness. Because it's not exactly like, you know, when you wake up, the dream's over. And when you're still in the body, you know, that's the body. So it's like the dream's over. So the dream, you may be in your dream, but Krishna conscious enough, you know that's just a dream. Interesting. Final paragraph. A devotee, now this goes back to text 26, a devotee always merges in transcendental happiness. And that's this apta nirvritti. Attained nirvritti. Transcendental bliss. It's spelled differently than, you know, anarta nirvritti. It's spelled different. This is transcendental bliss, different spelling. It sounds the same. A devotee always merges in transcendental happiness, and therefore he has no experience of material distresses. Transcendental to the material distresses. It doesn't mean there's no material distress, but transcendental, because consciousness is absorbed in Krishna. So much so. It's like, have you ever had the experience that you're so absorbed in something or other, somebody's calling you, and you don't even hear them? They call again, you're not even, they're standing there, you're not even aware, you're so absorbed. And then they tap you on the shoulder, oh. Like that? Only no experience of material distresses. This transcendental happiness is called eternal bliss according to the opinion of devotees. Constant remembrance of the Supreme Lord is called samadhi or trance. If one is constantly in trance, there's no possibility of his being attacked or even touched by the modes of material nature. Doesn't mean the modes of material nature go away. But it's like the example of Bhagavad Gita, the lotus that's untouched by water. So there can be a storm, and there's waves and water splashing, and the lotus is not touched by all of that because the lotus is above. If one's consciousness is absorbed in remembrance of Krishna, katayam nishchala mati, without wavering, flickering. We're wavering and flickering because of guna and karma. And when that the action of guna and karma upon our consciousness subsides, when we have that dharana or concentration, having heard properly, free from false ego, and attentive to, with faith, to the words of the persons who we're hearing from, or Prabhupada's Bhagavatam purports, then the door is open. We can enter. As soon as one is freed from the contamination of the three material modes, he no longer has to take birth to transmigrate from one form to another in this material world. Well, you know, it's not so easy, isn't it? It's easy, and it's not so easy. It's not so easy because of our attachment. Like the biblical saying, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. You've heard that one before? We're attached. It's exactly what Devahuti said earlier. I get the philosophy, but, you know, is it really possible to become free from the attachment to the temporary? Because look, everywhere is temporary, and we experience with knowledge there's some detachment, and then we go back down again to attachment. Knowledge seems to like fade, or it's the power of detachment seems to fade, and then we forget the knowledge, we're back in illusion again. So the influence, the modes of material nature are pretty persistent under the control of Maya, and Maya is under control of Krishna. So who's going to win? The modes of nature, or the living entity wants to be free from the modes of nature? Unless the Krishna factor comes in. And that's what's being described, that the force of bhakti is exactly Kapila Dev's teachings. Bhakti is the goal. Unmixed bhakti is the goal. That reference that was in the previous purport, 26, to chapter 29, the mode, bhakti that's unmixed with the modes, that's the goal. We're doing bhakti mixed. Most likely. Most probably. Bhakti that's mixed. And we must endeavor to the unmixed stage in order to become free from the influence of the modes. We must endeavor and cultivate. And we're hearing very clearly what are the steps or the principles that help us get there, unmixed bhakti. And then what's that like? So this unlimited bliss or eternal bliss, and the kleshas are no longer harassing you. The kleshas due to ignorance, illusion, by the influence of the modes of nature. It works. The process works. Now, sometimes devotees ask, is it really possible? And, well, the answer is, it's not exaggeration, or it's not a gimmick. A cheating gimmick, you say this and really you mean that. It's meant that we, exactly as Prabhupada says here, one can come to the platform of Devahuti and have the personality of Godhead as your son. My goodness. So you know, that's very elevated. But the process is meant to elevate us to that stage, the stage of perfection. Which is exactly the question at the very beginning: how can we reach this stage of perfection? Exactly what Yudhisthira's question was of Narada, the section we're reading from seventh canto. Wow, look at Prahlad Maharaj. What are the steps to get to that perfection? What's the function of Varnashram that helps one get to that stage of perfection? It's all meant to bring that. So we need to be clear what the goal is and not think, well, I'll never get there. Then you won't even try to get there. Or if you're, you know, a Mayavadi, you think you're already there. I don't need to try. And don't be discouraged that, you know, the goal is very high. We see what the goal is and we take steps to get to the goal. That's part of our discussion in our morning classes here. Take steps. Wherever we are, recognize, take steps toward the goal. Doable ones. Sustainable ones. Keep making steps. Little by little. We'll get to the goal. Not by your effort alone, by this mercy of the bhakti process and descending mercy that comes with it. Okay, so I'll end there. See if there's any discussion, yeah.
Maybe this is a further clarification on this point about forgetfulness of body. So what I understand is there are three ways, like, or three different varieties of it. One is a dissociated place where a person is dissociated.
A person is which?
Dissociated.
Dislocated.
Disassociated.
Disassociated. That means crazy.
And he thinks that he is forgetful of the body, but that's illusory, and in that also there is a lot of
This is clinical analysis. I don't know so much about it. Disassociated. I've heard the term,
okay.
And it's a clinical term. I don't know so much about it.
I think it's in someone's mind that this illusion that they think that they're forgetful of the body, but but to me it feels like it's actually self-absorption. But the person is thinking he's forgetful.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
The second one I was thinking about was the impersonal. So then a person realizes that identification with the body is the reason for suffering. So let me get out of it.
Yes, negation.
And then it's
artificial.
Or it's self-absorption.
Well, one is, they're both imagined.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the mind only. Mano retena. And then, the third?
So, before going to the third, the second one is like, they make that their goal, that they know that, so their goal is actually to come out of the suffering, that I don't like to suffer,
yes.
And that's my goal. And that's why I make so much effort to come out of identification.
Yes.
So eventually I don't have to suffer. So that's the primary drive,
yes,
in personalism.
Yeah. Well, you know, they may say, like for example, I know, because of visiting China, I'm more aware of the view of Buddhism than actually people that think that they're liberated. It's just, anyone that I've met that thinks they're liberated, it's just like, it's really silly. Anyway, whether it's impersonalism or voidism, aversion to suffering is certainly part of it, but there's an additional component, and that is striving for happiness. But the definition of that happiness is the negation of the illusion. And, you know, so there's different ideas of what the illusion is or what's on the other side of the illusion. And so one is the light and the other is nothingness.
So this is a symptom or a byproduct of being so much engaged in service.
Yes.
It just happens that the absorption is so much in service.
Well, it's not just so. It's not like being busy in service. It's absorption in the object, mm-hmm, of the service, mm-hmm, which then inspires the service. Absorption in the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, in the mood of serving Him. Mm-hmm. Little editing. Okay? Yes?
Mother Chaitanya, you're telling, going back to Godhead, Prabhupada says it's a very bona fide desire, but Mahaprabhu says, Mamajani Nijamanishwara, Bhakta Prabhupada Prabhupada. So, a normal aspirant in Hare Krishna mantra, should he aspire for going back to Godhead?
Yes. Prabhupada said, I very distinctly remember reading, you know, having this question and reading Prabhupada's explanation. It was a transcribed lecture, Bhagavatam lecture, and he was explaining, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, then he was saying, in the beginning stages, it's very beneficial to aspire to go back to Godhead because there's impetus to. It's not just relief of the misery portion, but it's being with Krishna portion. Both. And it's beneficial in the beginning stages. And in the stage that Mahaprabhu was describing, that's whatever you want. If you wish. I don't have a requisition slip in my hand that says, get me out of here. I'm ready just to be in your service. And so the relationship is everything. Then, you know, similarly, you can embrace me, you can neglect me. There's only one thing. Please keep me engaged in your service. Wherever. So in the beginning, wanting to go back to Godhead is good. Gives us a very clear goal. It's really high, but it's a clear goal. And the other one is it within our reach? And if one says, yeah, that's artificial. Another one?
Yes.
Yeah.
We should
do what?
You know, always I quote like, we should do this, we should do this. We should control our senses, we should control our mind, get rid of the false ego. But really, you know, over a period of time I meditated on this. we can't get rid of anything, you know, Krishna's mercy has to work. So, I mean, we endure, without that mercy,
yes,
nothing actually really happens.
But making the endeavor is also needed. There's two things. Prayasa and mercy, kripa. The bhakti process requires both. It's a relationship. We make some endeavor, Krishna gives his mercy. He sees the endeavor, he gives his mercy. He's ready to give his mercy even without our endeavor, but when he sees the endeavor, and you know the right kind of endeavor, and it's his bhakti shakti that dissolves the false ego and the material mind and the material intelligence. That's Kapila's teaching. But, you know, that's Krishna's mercy. We have to make some endeavor. It's both. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains in the Damodar Leela, the 2 inches represents these two things. Endeavor and mercy.
Means we have to wait until that mercy comes.
We continue to endeavor and hope against hope, because otherwise there's no hope. We can't do it alone. Not possible. It's Krishna's potency. He put it exactly as Devahuti says, the very beginning. You put it here. You can remove it. Can you remove it? And he removes it, but not just like, okay, now it's gone. He gives her a process that she makes some endeavor, and then it's removed. It's the relationship and connecting with that relationship through that process and the endeavor, abhyasa, mercy, combination of the two. Abhyasa or prayasa. Jnane prayasa. We don't endeavor to cultivate speculative knowledge and get there, but bhakti prayasa. Endeavor to be in Krishna's service and endeavor to go back to Godhead, to be with Krishna eternally. And then you're really elevated, you're with Krishna eternally. You can be wherever and be with Krishna. That's highly elevated. Anything else? Yes?
I think it's more... I'm getting a little more clarity on why I asked the first question.
Okay.
I'm thinking, like, one of the things that I'm understanding is that many a time when I introspect myself and I get this answer, that the motivation for doing a service or anything to me is that I don't want to suffer.
Yeah.
And that's like more fear-based. And is it that I have to that consciously make the goal clearer that I want to serve Krishna?
Yeah.
And so the shift of not just out of...
Yeah. It instead of motivation on this selfish platform, it's motivation on the Krishna platform, Krishna Bhakti platform. And it's a major shift, a major paradigm shift from I'm at the center. And I mean, think about it for a moment. What's it like to think, I mean, we're thinking I'm the center. Even if we're trying to be a nice devotee, everything is in terms of how I perceive things, because the soul is the seat of consciousness. We're conscious in consciousness. What's it like where Krishna is at the center? We're still conscious, but Krishna is at the center, not I'm at the center. Either the enjoyer or the renouncer. Or I don't want to suffer. It says, what's it like when Krishna's happiness is at the center? And my happiness is Krishna's happiness. That's love. That's where we're supposed to be cultivating or headed to. It's not like the light goes out and now we're not conscious, it's just Krishna, but we're conscious of Krishna's happiness. That's yoga, bhakti yoga. We practice it, cultivate it. And certainly what you said fits. But, you know, it's a shift from the motivation of not wanting to suffer, whether it's the first two, either of the first two. Anything else? Yes?
Madam, under our last, like, you know, in the regular court system, before the punishment is given, and the judge tells the, you know, the convict, you know, the accused, so this is what you have done, that's why you are punished. And they already ask, you know, we go through so much suffering, we have no idea, you know, why I'm going through this, if only Paramatma reveals. But then we'll not be able to do it again next
time. No.
why are we not told that, you know?
Well, we're told in principle, we may not know the detail. The principle is we turned our back on Krishna. We just, you know, acted for our own erroneous self-interest, our own concocted idea of what's our self-interest. That, you know, Bahir Mukhajiv, that's the cause. And then there's detail. So you can know the detail. It doesn't take away the Bahir Mukhajiv part. Knowledge is not sufficient. And, you know, there's many examples. It's right in the Canto 6, Chapter 1, where Maharaj Pariksit is asking Shukadeva Goswami, you just described the hellish planets as the destination of people that have done sins. What's the antidote for sins? So one is you counteract the sin by karma kanda. Well, that's not sufficient because the tendency to sin remains, even if the reaction is neutralized. Very good. So now you need knowledge, because then you won't do it again because you know it'll bring suffering. But knowledge, we know things and we still do them anyway. You know, things that we shouldn't do or things that we should do. We don't. Knowledge alone isn't enough. We may do it for a while and then we don't do it anymore. Knowledge alone isn't enough. Knowledge is good. It's the same as Devahuti. Knowledge brings detachment and then goes back to attachment. The bungee cord. Because we've been so long and we're conditioned by lifetimes and lifetimes and the force of material nature has got us bound up. You can be detached for a bit through knowledge and then modes of nature will cover over the knowledge again. And there you go. The knowledge isn't enough. Super Soul could give us a whole list. We do it again. Because tendency is there. And how does that residual tendency get removed? There's only one, Krishna. Jnana dipena basvata. That's the residual tendency antidote. Krishna removes it. Personally. We can't. Knowledge doesn't do it. We can't. We're under the whammy. We can't remove the whammy. We're just Krishna's energy. We can't overcome Krishna's energy with knowledge. Even if you had it. Yes.
We've been reading Bhagavad Gita chapter 10 and Krishna says what use is all this knowledge. I noticed devotees lately especially getting wrapped up in the cosmology given in the Vedas and a lot of back and forth about what it is and what it isn't, and sometimes I wonder what is the utility of that within the general sangha and what is our real goal. So I know Prabhupada put importance on it.
Sure.
I'm not questioning that.
So does Shukadeva Goswami. You know, I can't recall exactly where I read this, or maybe you just heard it. I can't recall for sure. But something to the effect, heard it or read it, that this detailed information, it's like Sankhya, the detailed information is there for the higher purpose of showing that everything is connected to Krishna. So one may get absorbed in the detail of Sankhya. You know, this causes that, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and is it really this way, or is it that way? And so those that have this penchant for discerning and trying to understand by discerning, they can use it in these areas. And because the goal is Krishna, it helps purify. You can just even take, aside from cosmology, one who studies the sacred conversation is worshipping me with their intelligence. So just take Bhagavad Gita. What does it mean when Krishna says such and such? You know, we use our intellect. We use our capacity to analyze or discriminate between this and that. That capacity isn't going to give an understanding of Bhagavad Gita or cosmology or Sankhya or anything. But we use it anyway under the authority. So the bigger goal is, what's the message? And how is this message going to help us reach Krishna? Sadaputta shared with me that whatever the year was, 1975 or something like that, Prabhupada told him, instructed him, study the fifth canto, and based upon your study of the fifth canto, make a design for the planetarium. So what's he going to do? He has to use his analytical ability. But, you know, he was a genius, so he had a special capacity. And it doesn't mean that everybody that has looked at the fifth canto is going to come to the same conclusion that Sadaputta did. But, you know, he researched what Acharyas said and so forth and so on, and he wasn't, you know, he had the force of Prabhupada's instruction to do so. But that was what was carrying the whole effort, you know, to a wonderful position. Some persons don't have the instruction to do so. They just like to use their intellect, and perhaps maybe it seems to me this over here and that over there, and put the pieces together. And the power of intelligence to discriminate and analyze, it's natural. And when doing so, is it easy to get the goal, to lose sight of the goal? Real easy. But those that have bhakti, they have that inquisitive spirit. There's a really nice example. I'm sure you'll like it. You maybe have heard it. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was studying Chaitanya Charitamrita, and he read the section from Chaitanya Charitamrita where it says the Gopal mantra has some number of 17 and a half syllables or whatever the number is. And he couldn't understand it. So he was reading and praying and pondering, and he couldn't get an answer. And the way that the history says, he got to the point where, what's the use if I can't have a proper understanding of Gayatri mantra? What's the use of my life? So he decided to sit by the side of Radhakund and fast till death. I mean, and he dozed off, and Radharani appeared in his dream by the side of Radhakund and said, "Oh, Vishwanath, your desire to understand the truths of the Vedas is very wonderful. The source that Krishnadas Kaviraj used was such and such grammar text that says when such and such then counts as a half a syllable, because you never heard of a half a syllable. And so once you have found that, please write a commentary on Gayatri Mantra. And I will help you. Something like that. So his dream broke. He was relieved. The next morning he went, found that dictionary, or excuse me, the grammar text. And sure enough, exactly what Radharani said in the dream, there it was. And then he wrote a commentary on Gayatri. And it's now translated into English, Compliments of Bhanuswami. But, you know, his was driven by bhakti to try to understand something that's... I mean, it turns out it was really easy, but, you know, he was really determined to understand. So, when it's driven by bhakti and not just, I want it, you know, speculative, I want to exercise my speculative faculties... You know, and it has its proper place. And commonly, you know, the other is the case.
So that sense of bhakti would have been this sense of humility that I can't do any service if I can't even figure out this.
Well, not figure it out, but if I'm in ignorance about what this primary, the source of all the Vedas, the Gayatri Mantra, and Krishna Das Kaviraj is sharing it, and I can't fathom it. It's a detail, or it's like whatever you want to characterize. It's not the essence of Gayatri Mantra, but he felt impelled. That was his nature, the strength of his desire to know, but driven by bhakti, and then it was disclosed. No harm to be really fixed and want to know, but that it should be driven by bhakti, not something else. The ascending effort. Okay, thank you very much, Prabhupada.
Jai.
Been very nice spending some days with all of you. Look forward to come back again. We'll probably be in another canto by then. But there's some sections I skipped of canto 3, and let's see what happens. I did a little research. There was a question yesterday about Kapila Dev as a Shakti Veshavatar. And research says no mention at all that Kapila Dev was a Shakti Veshavatar. There's two sections of Lagu Bhagavatamrita that include Kapila Dev in the Leela Avatar section, although there's not extensive Leela, there's some Leela. And this Prabhav Avatar, which is a meaning forms of Vishnu, the big heading is Anksha Avatar, and his subsection is Prabhav. So he's a Vishnu form that does not exhibit the fullness of the potencies of Vishnu. So those two categories. It's not one of the six, but he's Vishnu Tattva. At least that's the understanding given in Lagu Bhagavatamrita. And from what I've learned, there may be some other references somewhere that says something like that, and it's another manifestation of Kapila in some other yoga cycle or something, if it says like that. But the preponderance of information is, there isn't any exceptional information that I've come across, he's Vishnu Tattva. And performed some pastimes. And there's no Shakti. There's no, he's, you know, sannyasi. There's no potency of Narayana or Vishnu mentioned at all. Okay, Hare Krishna. Mm-hmm.